This week on Vox Talks, a powerful group demands that governments protect their wealth, even if this undermines global financial stability and makes crises worse. And the bad guys are you. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. When there's a financial crisis, policymakers and politicians increasingly kowtow to the demands of an influential group that bad banks should be bailed out. And this group expects that politicians will act to look after their wealth, and it punishes those politicians if they don't. And the more influence this group exerts, the more fragile the financial system becomes. But this time, we're not talking about the 1% or the deep state. According to a new book, it's the expectations of the middle classes that are skewing policy. And this has been happening for decades. The authors of this book have joined me today to tell me about middle class expectations, their impact on our economy, and what this will mean when the next crisis hits. Jeffrey Schweroff is at the London School of Economics. He also works with the Systemic Risk Centre there. And Andrew Walter joins us from the University of Melbourne. Jeff and Andrew, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim.
Hello, Tim.
You talk about the great expectations of middle class voters. What are these expectations?
So essentially what we're doing is we're focusing on the heightened demand by large segments of contemporary society, roughly what we talk about as the middle class, for policies and measures that protect their wealth and their income, particularly after the damage that banking crises can inflict upon them. So we're thinking here about the consequences that this group's rising material stake has in the financial system and how this incentivizes them or orients them towards having strong and intense preferences for a government to provide them with wealth protection.
Andrew, how broadly are you defining the middle class here?
Well, historically, people define the middle class in income terms. So when we think about the middle class, for example, in the second half of the 19th century in the book, we're talking about a pretty small proportion of the adult population, even in very developed countries like the UK or Australia. So we're talking about perhaps 5, maybe 10% of the population. Over time, the proportion of people that we broadly think of as middle class in income terms increases quite dramatically over the course of the 20th century. When we're thinking about the middle class, we're particularly thinking about the way from about the 1960s, 1970s, that the wealth holdings of the middle class, especially defined in terms of things like house ownership, pension assets, and other financial assets, that increases quite dramatically. And so we think about this emerging middle class, especially in wealth terms, which is somewhat different to how I think a lot of the literature does.
Do you define it the same way all over the world? Because, of course, in wealth terms, that could mean something entirely different, can't it?
Yeah, it could. So we look at a number of countries in the advanced world, of course, where the middle class is quite extensive. And I think we could broadly think of the middle class in countries like the UK, Australia, much of Western Europe and North America as at least 50% of the voting population of the households in those countries, and perhaps up to 60 or 70% in some cases. But we also look at emerging countries and indeed some poorer developing countries. We only look at democracies in the book. Those countries, of course, have smaller middle classes, especially when we're talking about some of the poorer developing countries. But as we've seen in countries right across the world, from Asia to sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, they have rising middle classes in the way that we think about them. They don't necessarily enjoy the same levels of income or wealth holdings as in countries like the UK or Australia, but increasingly, and certainly they aspire, I think, to own like the middle class and to consume like the middle class in many of the advanced countries.
Jeff, Andrew gave us a clue there on how they might affect policy choices, I suppose. You're only looking at democracies. Is this the way in which they are influencing policy?
I think what we would point to is two broad-based mechanisms through which the middle class see their policy preferences translated into the outcomes that we observe. One is maybe straightforward electoral accountability. So you mentioned in your intro that voters increasingly lash out against incumbent politicians when they fail to protect their wealth. So the straightforward idea that in democracies that incumbent politicians that fail to respond to voters' demands or preferences will be voted out of office clearly incentivizes politicians to respond to middle-class demands or preferences. The other mechanism is related and associated with more sort of social legitimacy imperatives, that governments and democracies respond to societal pressures or orientations as ways to maintain their claim to legitimacy and legitimate governance over the society. Now, you mentioned democracies. I think that our argument does travel somewhat in the sense that even in these non-democratic or less democratic regimes, although we wouldn't talk about electoral accountability, we might talk about selectoral accountability in the sense that the government is still responsive to some segment of the population and does still face these legitimacy imperatives. So these types of arguments, although we focus on democracies and we focus in the book on the importance of the middle class becoming, as Andrew suggested, if not the majority of potential voters in many democracies, at least a significant proportion of voters in democracies, or at least aspire to become part of the middle classes, that these types of pressures on governments to provide these policies should translate in these other settings as well.
When did this begin? How long has it been going on for?
If we think back historically, there was in many ways a kind of revolution in thinking about economic policy coming out of the Great Depression associated with John Maynard Keynes. And a lot of this thinking in policy terms was in a sense a reflection of what was then perceived as mass preference for income and employment stabilization, things that were certainly not achieved in the Great Depression era, but where particularly after the war, a number of political parties on the left and even on the center-right in many democracies started accepting the principle that governments ought to be responsive to income and employment stabilization preferences on the part of many voters, and political movements like unions, of course. But over time, and particularly from the 1970s, we think that as the middle class begins to shift in terms of its material interests away from sort of primarily income stabilization preferences towards wealth protection and wealth promotion preferences. So from the 1970s and 80s, and we can see politicians like Margaret Thatcher in the UK, Ronald Reagan in the United States, of course, and their equivalents elsewhere, increasingly promoting financial liberalization, encouraging the accumulation of financial wealth and housing wealth, promoting house ownership, for example, promoting the liberalization of the financial system to provide mortgage credit and other forms of consumer credit. So that's all going on, and in a sense, again, is reflecting some shifting preferences. So we think that the middle class has been politically influential and in many ways a kind of decisive block of voters from sometime in the early to mid 20th century in the relatively advanced democracies, but their preferences are shifting over time. And so they're what we would call and others call wealth or asset dominance increasingly begins to take over in terms of the kinds of policies that this cohort is effectively demanding from governments.
You've used some, how shall I phrase this, unconventional economic data, Jeff, to support your argument. For example, you've been examining the tone of newspaper editorials or interpreting government policy responses. Isn't this very subjective?
Yeah, so this was a crucial part of the book and the research project that we undertook, which was how could we actually identify empirically these great expectations that we thought were so influential in shaping policy and political outcomes. And so ideally from the start, we thought, well, it would be great if we had longitudinal household surveys asking voters about, you know, what do they think about X and Y in terms of government policy responses and responsibility for financial stability. But, you know, these types of surveys don't become available, any public opinion surveys, until the mid-1930s, and only then in a few countries and not really relevant for what we were interested in doing. What we did instead was piggyback on a larger literature associated with public opinion and thinking about citizen attention and voter attitudes and political salience and so on, which uses, you know, newspaper editorials and newspaper coverage as a proxy for both citizen attention to particular issues, but also citizen opinion or values or opinions associated with a particular set of views. We tried to be careful in the book in terms of thinking about the usefulness of these data, but also some of the caveats or issues associated with it. And so we fully recognize that, you know, newspapers will in part reflect elite opinions and, you know, just like any newspaper coverage will suffer from some form of political bias. But what we tried to suggest is that, you know, over time, they should bear at least some general relationship to broader public opinion, particularly when we know from a set of other research that mass public typically takes their cues from these opinion leaders. And additional research shows us that newspapers always have a strong incentive to tailor their opinion to the beliefs of their consumers. So essentially, they are sort of a rough proxy for this. The methods that we try to use to make it less unconventional, to use your phrase, is to rely on rigorous content analysis of the argument patterns that we found in these data. So essentially what we do is we set up a team of RAs, many of whom were native language speakers, particularly when we were looking at Brazil, we're looking at Portuguese language newspapers dating back sometimes to the late 19th century. And we extensively trained these individuals and engaged in the reliability testing and pre-testing, where we asked these coders to apply a particular protocol. And they went back and talked to Andrew and I about these different things. And we tested them again and again and again until they reached a particular level of agreement. And then we finished off by randomly assigning these individuals to different crises to ensure that any error balances out or is randomly distributed across them. And then finally, we engage in sort of standard sets of tests to see whether or not the coders were actually reliable in terms of providing their decisions. And we found that they more than met the standards that were appropriate. And importantly for us is not only did this show the pattern that we're hoping that it would show, but when we actually then look at these data and try to match it to the countries where we actually have household opinion data. So only very recently do we find regulators beginning to ask citizens for questions that are roughly similar to what we're interested in about, you know, how do you think that government should risk bail in times of financial distress? You know, who's responsible for financial stability and these sorts of things. And we find that in the countries where we actually have these data, that these data match exactly what we find in our newspaper content analysis. So essentially, the content analysis is matching up with the survey data. And then in the empirical chapters, of which there are three different country cases in UK, US, and Brazil, what we find in the newspapers actually mirrors what we observe in the empirical study. So this boosts our confidence that we're being fairly rigorous and fairly precise in identifying that these expectations did emerge and that these newspaper opinions are at least proxying or serving as a good measure of the general emergence of these great expectations over time.
But surely the story of certainly the last 10 years has been that middle-class people don't feel particularly powerful at the moment and they don't feel that their preferences are being taken account of by politicians. Certainly there have been populist movements directly based on this. Isn't it more likely that the large shareholders of the banks are having the impact on policy? It just so happens that the middle classes have benefited because they're the customers of those banks.
There were some prominent books and articles written about how so-called financial sector capture was the predominant characteristic of the crisis responses. The former chief economist of the IMF, Simon Johnson, made this argument, and many other people. So this wasn't a radical left critique of the interventions that occurred after 2007, though it was also made by members of the radical left. So it's a very prominent argument in the literature and one that we disagree with, not completely, but partly. The other thing to say is that it's certainly true that many middle-class people don't feel powerful in a crisis. And I think that individual members of the middle class, individual voters, individual households, in a sense, feel disempowered during a crisis, even if, I think at a broader level, one can see governments, at least in part, responding to the preferences and interests of middle-class households who are exposed with large mortgages, with significant pension assets at risk, and so on. What we argue is that although this financial capture by elites, by the City of London, Wall Street, and their equivalents elsewhere, we're not denying that this played some role in the crisis. But if you think back to some of the big earlier crises, for example, in the 1850s, 60s, 1890 in the UK, there were serious crises in 1907 in the United States. It's quite likely that financial and business elites were more influential at that time and more likely to be able to exercise influence over policy outcomes than they were in the 2007-9 period, for example. Yet what we find in those earlier crises is that those elites, at least in the context of electoral democracy with at least adult male full enfranchisement, that elite power, in effect, was not sufficient to induce governments to undertake large bailouts of the kind that we saw after 2007. So essentially what we're arguing is that financial elite influence and power has always been there. What's changed is that this decisive voting block of mass middle-class voters who can swing from centre-right to centre-left often and are typically associated with support for mainstream political parties can be decisive and, in effect, put their weight behind governments that are also bailing out the City of London or Wall Street. But it's important to think about the way that key politicians, I think, in crises framed the interventions and attempted to defend them. Gordon Brown, for example, in the UK, George W. Bush, before Obama in the United States, appealed to the interests of the middle class and appealed to voters to believe them. And I think in some ways they also believed the argument that they made, that their actions were not bailouts of the City of London or of Wall Street. The bailouts were of Main Street and the middle class, protecting people with exposed housing and pension wealth. So we think it's the combination of middle class interests and pressure, as well as pressure certainly from financial and business elites, that in combination is incredibly difficult for governments in the modern era to resist.
There was also very good policy reasons for the bailouts in the last crisis. The interconnectedness of the financial system, middle class wealth had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, so in the book, we don't deny the importance of interconnectedness and network density and complexity as a key feature of what was on the minds of policymakers at the time. But what we try to add to that is this idea that there was an underlying political imperative associated with network density, complexity, interconnectedness that gave rise to powerful incentives for policymakers to provide these financial rescues. So essentially, this idea is that the interconnectedness of the financial system would have led to wide systemic collapse. And in the presence of systemic collapse with middle-class wealth highly threatened, policymakers felt a strong political imperative to intervene. And there's something to this in terms of thinking about how financial market actors react and the sort of broader economics literature on this, which essentially suggests to us that, you know, a larger shock in a dense financial network will heighten the possibility of systemic collapse. And that gives rise to strong incentives for actors to suggest that if we fail to act in this particular manner, or if we try to do something about complexity, that this will actually harm credit provision and give rise to resentment among the middle classes. So there's sort of the broader political story that we're trying to tell here, which is that this also creates important political incentives for policymakers to intervene. And this is an important part of the story as well.
And Jeff, will the changes that we have seen in regulation since the last crisis that make it impossible in many cases for policymakers to intervene with bailouts, will that solve this problem?
We do spend a fair bit of time in the book trying to think about how these measures relate to the core aspects of our argument. And I think what you're suggesting here is this idea that perhaps if we imposed a greater market discipline on banks, introducing things like living wills or bail-in type measures that force creditors to take losses, or new resolution regimes that enable us to more easily wind up banks, or even other limits on the ability of governments perhaps to intervene. So we do talk about these measures, but I think that both of us are somewhat skeptical about whether or not these particular types of measures will actually prove robust in the presence of these great expectations of the middle class. We talk about in the book this idea of a ratchet effect. Crises, when they occur, lead governments to intervene in new ways. And then when these new interventions occur, these in turn ratchet up expectations of voters such that it becomes more difficult for governments to remove these once they're in place. And we talk about this in the context of the introduction first in the UK in the 1850s of a modest form of deposit insurance for a limited number of savings banks associated with the poorer working classes. And then we relate this back to more recent introductions of insurance with respect to deposits and the difficulties that governments have of removing these guarantees once they're in play. And then more recently, we point to the example that occurred in Italy in 2017, where despite rules that are put in place in the Eurozone associated with resolution regimes and bail-in, what we found in the context of the Italian case was that the government was able to find convenient loopholes around these measures, so they were able to provide bailouts of two medium-sized munition banks, as well as a larger Italian bank later on. This is a key example of, even after these 10 years of efforts to ramp up market discipline, that at the end of this, in the face of strong societal pressures, particularly in the Italian case, where we saw a large proportion of middle-class individuals exposed to potential losses on bank bonds, that we saw that the Italian government looked for ways around these measures, and we would expect this to be prevalent in other cases in the future as well.
Andrew, isn't there an argument that this is the system working? If you give the middle classes a financial stake in society, they're behaving rationally when they defend that and demand protection to defend that and vote for it. Is it ever going to be possible to align their interests and your aspirations for financial stability?
Well, I think that's a really good question that comes to the heart of whether there are any viable policy solutions. I think we might distinguish the short-term rational interests of individuals in a crisis. So, for example, when the US Congress at the end of September, I think, 2008, failed to pass the Bush administration's first TARP proposal, a lot of voters rushed to phone their members of Congress and demanded more serious action, and that began to shift some key Republican members. Now, that's in their short-term rational interest to undertake that sort of pressure. But short-term rationality is not always consistent with the long-term rational self-interest of individuals, voters, or indeed society as a collective. What we're arguing is that great expectations put voters and the political system on a kind of treadmill whereby the wealth that is increasingly tied to complex financial markets, pension, other asset wealth, and particularly leveraged housing wealth, is increasingly at risk. When financial stability gets out of hand, that threatens that wealth. The interventions that follow, in most cases, even if sometimes slowly and with delays that annoy much of the middle class and make them very angry, the government interventions generally are nevertheless forthcoming, and that in turn, in effect, socializes some of that risk and puts a floor under asset prices, even when they do fall, relative to a kind of counterfactual world in which governments didn't intervene at all, as was the case in a lot of the crises in the 19th century. So we're on some kind of unfortunate conveyor belt that seems to be very difficult to get off. Now, how do we better align the incentives of middle-class asset holders who, over the past few decades, not only have acquired wealth, but have acquired wealth that's highly connected to complex and sometimes unstable financial markets, but increasingly a whole series of public policies that have privatized pensions, that have shifted people from defined benefit towards defined contribution pensions, raising the risk to recipients? We have deregulated the financial system, and we see the consequences of rising household leverage right across much of the industrialized world and many emerging and developing countries too, increasingly. So it's very difficult to think of circumstances or mechanisms that would align household and voter preferences in ways more consistent with financial stability unless we begin to ratchet down levels of leverage in the household sector, and unless we begin to think about novel ways of risk sharing, for example, with respect to key forms of wealth like pension assets. So I think one of the implications of our argument is that we might need to think again about the shift, for example, from defined benefit to defined contribution schemes, which has driven those short-term preferences.
You looked at the story for the United States and Europe and Brazil as well, but the big economic story when it comes to middle classes has been the rise of the middle class in India, China, other emerging economies. So are we going to see this pattern repeated there?
I mean, I would suggest to you that we're already seeing that pattern repeated in these countries. We do talk a few times in the book about developments in China with respect to its ability to dampen financial distress in its economy. We talk about the importance of household wealth in India. But more recently, just this month, we saw at least two examples from each of these different countries where we saw governments on the side of protecting household wealth. We saw a case in China where one of the leading banks sold wealth management products to individual investors. When these individual investors then incurred losses as a result of these wealth management products due to the stock market crash, the government ruled that the banks themselves must compensate the individuals who took on the risk associated with these products. So this is a clear source of an implicit guarantee, if not explicit guarantee, by the Chinese government in order to protect household wealth. In the case of India, which is, like China, increasingly faced with financial vulnerabilities or fragilities in its banking system, we've seen efforts by the authorities to deal with this distress by aiding depositors. We saw attempts to introduce legislation to force losses on depositors fail because it was seen as too stringent. And so what we're seeing in the case of India as well is that the government, rather than trying to introduce greater market discipline or the types of things that Andrew was just suggesting and dealing with middle class expectations, what we're seeing instead is government willingness to side on the side of household wealth protection. That's not even going into this longer story we could have about the importance and the growing importance of household leverage in both of these countries and as well as other emerging market economies in terms of consumer borrowing, in terms of household borrowing to finance increasingly pricey public services. So we would wholly expect to see this story repeated elsewhere. In fact, Andrew and I have a paper that we're working on where we're precisely looking at these types of dynamics in these emerging markets and as well as in a less democratic settings for the reasons I told you about earlier.
Is the conclusion that I'm taking away from this, the rather depressing one, that the world's economy is more stable when the middle classes are smaller or they're poorer or they're easier to ignore? And you have to remember that the Vox Talks audience is pretty middle class, isn't it?
I guess it is. So that therefore could not be our answer, could it? And I think what we're seeing around the world is what we would call a lot of wealth anxiety, as well as income and status anxiety amongst much of the middle class. And so I don't think either Jeff or I would be advocating making the middle class more anxious, less comfortable than they currently are. There's a lot of the middle class in many developed countries, and dare I say, Brexit Britain is a shining example of this, where many middle class people feel as though they're already getting smaller, poorer, and lacking political influence. If you look at many of the surveys, the sort of people who are opting for populist parties, who are aligning themselves with anti-European populism, stalwart Donald Trump supporters. These are precisely the sort of people who feel that they have suffered quite dramatically, particularly since the global financial crisis, and where they also tend to hold the view that they lack political voice in what is described as a democracy, but which doesn't feel like a democracy to them. So I think the kind of political backlash that we're seeing is in part, though not only, a consequence of the crisis and the various interventions that followed, but we certainly wouldn't advocate making that situation worse. So what we need to do is adopt the policies which promote a middle class, which, as we were saying earlier, have a set of incentives that are more aligned with financial stability than currently is the case.
And for me, I would just point out that we try to dwell on this in the book, where we think about this idea that there's a potential trilemma at work in terms of the mutual incompatibility associated with democratic politics, rising financialization, and financial stability, showing that how these three things often are unable to exist simultaneously in the context of the analysis that we provide. And, you know, I agree with Andrew here that what needs to occur is not to sacrifice democratic politics, obviously, or financial stability, but to try to target the second one, which is rising financialization. And the things that we have in mind here, I think, are an honest political conversation by mainstream political parties of the center that essentially make the argument that for the sake of your own wealth, which is now increasingly at risk from financial stability, but also for the sake of your own democratic institutions, Andrew suggested to you the increasing receptiveness of anxious voters to populist political parties, many of whom threaten democratic norms and institutions, that voters need to accept and be increasingly convinced of the desirability, the necessity of curtailing financial risk associated with excessive house price booms, excessive leverage in the system, and so on. And this is a politically difficult conversation that mainstream political parties need to have with voters, but it is one, ultimately, I think, that they'd be receptive to, given the right frames associated with the importance of democratic institutions and long-term wealth accumulation.
And to any politicians and policymakers about to make that argument, I say, good luck to you. Jeff and Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Now, the book is The Wealth Effect: How the Great Expectations of the Middle Class Have Changed the Politics of Banking Crises. It's from Cambridge University Press. And if you want a primer on this, then there's a Vox column, which is called The Wealth Effect: The Middle Class and the Changing Politics of Banking Crises. that sets out these arguments. Authors in both cases, of course, are Jeffrey Schweroff and Andrew Walter. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We're here every Friday, so subscribe and then you won't miss an episode. And there are 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.